Hello, everyone. And we want to thank everyone for calling in. We know it's the middle of the day. I'm actually calling in myself with Rabbi Judah Isaacs, the head of our community engagement from Lake Tahoe, California. We are in the process of having a rabbinic conference with 30 young rabbis from throughout North America. This afternoon, we here in Lake Tahoe, the young rabbis, Rabbi Isaacs and myself, together with all of us, board members, members of the RCA, and we want to thank our very special partners, Rabbi Lenny Matanky, Rabbi Mark Dratch, and Rabbi Shalom Baum, the leadership of the RCA, we have the honor of listening today to the preeminent American Jewish sociologist, Dr. Stephen Cohn. Dr. Stephen Cohn, as you know, is on staff at Hebrew Union College. Dr. Stephen Cohn runs the Mandel Berman Center at NYU, and he was the key consultant overseeing the Pew Report. He's a person that we at the RCA and the OU have a long-standing relationship with, and he's a person of great depth and insight. He's going to share with us today many findings from the Pew Report that one wouldn't necessarily see on the surface. He's also going to share with us today an insight as to what we, the Orthodox community, can take and what the Pew Report says to us vis-a-vis our responsibilities to the greater Jewish community moving forward. Without further ado, on behalf of our good friend, Mayor Furtick, Mayor Furtick, who put this together, the OU's Director of Communications, on behalf of Rabbi Judah Isaacs and myself, it is a great honor to welcome Dr. Stephen Cohn. For those of you who will have questions after Dr. Cohn's report, we ask you, if you're using Twitter, to use hashtag OUPewReport. I repeat, hashtag OUPewReport to send in to submit questions. Without further ado, Dr. Cohn.
Thank you, Rabbi Weil, for that extravagant and largely accurate introduction. The only inaccuracy that I will correct is that I wasn't the key consultant. I didn't guide the Pew Report. I helped out. They asked me questions. I gave a few answers. So, with that correction that I had to make, because who knows, Pew people might be listening. What I'd like to do is just provide a basic overview of the results. I mean, I know many people have been able to read it, but I do have a little bit of a different look at them, and I've calculated some numbers that are some consequence. First of all, one has to be struck by the extent to which the Pew Report, in many sense, resembles the work that we did in the New York Jewish Community Study. Very similar findings. One, you know, like, which report are you reading when you read the following? Orthodox population growing considerably. What I call borderland Jews, Jews who are not all that engaged in Jewish life, who have other identities, Jewish and something else, and so on, are growing in number. The center, which is neither Orthodox nor borderland, you know, somewhat engaged, committed center, often with attached to other denominations, conservative, reform, and otherwise, those people are declining in number, and their involvement in Jewish life, however we measure it, seems to be declining, and we just hit an all-time high in intermarriage rates. Happened in New York within the New York basis, and also happened here in Pew. So there are huge parallels between the two studies, which gives us a sense that whatever the defects in one or the other study, and now we're talking about the Pew, and what are the defects in the Pew study, and I guess there are some in all reports, in all the work that we do, the basic themes are, in my mind, entirely accurate, and we need to accept them as fact, and then devise policy. What are we seeing that's as fact? Within self-defined orthodoxy, and let me be clear, no one did a cystis check or a kerchief check on the people who said I'm orthodox. We have people who say they're orthodox. That's an orthodox Jew, self-identified orthodox. Some of whom you would say, oh no, that person's not orthodox. But understand that's why we do all these studies. Among those who are self-defined orthodox, we find that the projected birth rate is somewhere around 4.1. In contrast to non-Orthodox, where it's about 1.7. Among those who are currently Orthodox, the intermarriage rate is nearly zero. Caution, when we get the data, and I don't have the data, all I have is the report. When we get the data, we will find out that more people who were raised Orthodox, even people who were raised Orthodox recently, will have intermarried than the 1%. In other words, the 1% is people who now say they're Orthodox. Obviously, what happened over time is that some fraction of people who were raised Orthodox married a non-Jew, and they knew well enough that they can't call themselves Orthodox anymore. So the 1% is as compared to the other denominations, is an after-the-fact number, not a before-the-fact number. Having said that, I'm sure that the percentage who were raised Orthodox who are intermarried still is much lower than the other groups. So we have high birth rate, low intermarriage, and therefore we also know that the in-married produce Jewishly identified children a lot more than the intermarried. And they also produce children who are Jewish by religion, which is associated with higher levels of Jewish engagement. So the other thing we know that's not in the report is that while 10% of the adult Jewish population self-defines as Orthodox, I asked the good people at Pew to please write me the numbers for today's phone call. I asked them, what percent of Jewish children are Orthodox or in Orthodox homes? That's all we know. And they said the numbers are around 23%. So we're moving towards expansion. In New York, just to give a sense we have a larger Haredi population than the Orthodox than in the country as a whole, we found 20% of the adults or the households were Orthodox, and 61% of the children are Orthodox. In New York City, 74% of the children are Orthodox. There are more Hasidic children in the New York area than there are conservative Reform put together. Just to give a sense of the size of the Orthodox children's population. So these numbers, 20 is 60, 10 is 23, that sort of age difference is found in both reports. Also, the other thing that we know is that among adults, 18 and over, the Orthodox mean age is 40, and for conservative Reform Jews, it's mid-50s, 55 for conservative, 54 for Reform, not much difference, which indicates that younger adults are much more likely to be Orthodox. That in turn affected the number that the intermarriage number that we saw broadcast. And as of 1990, As of 1990, we think that around 43% of Jews married non-Jews in the prior 5 years. In the year 2000, that number had grown to 47%. And in the Pew study, 2013, a few years before that, it had grown to 58%. And I asked the people at Pew, could you please run that number again, but take out the Orthodox. The Orthodox are not only 10% of the recently marrying people. They are unusually young, and they are unusually marrying. For those two reasons, they're much more, I don't know the exact number, but they're much more of the recently marrying population than 10%. So when you pull them out, given that they're hardly intermarried, the percentage of non-Orthodox people who have intermarried jumps to 71.5%, which is what we found, which is what the New York Times reported. And so we're living in a period of where the vast majority of non-Orthodox people are going to marry non-Jews. Now, there are those in the community who say, well, it's not so terrible because I happen to know lots of intermarried people who are engaged in Jewish life. I happen to know lots of intermarried people who raise Jewishly committed kids. That they do. But anecdotes don't make data. And the data are when you call people up, you find out what's going on. You find out that virtually all, actually not all, but virtually something like, I think, 88% of children of two Jewish parents grow up to say that they're Jewish. And among Orthodox, it looks to be around, among the intermarried, it looks to be around 43%. Could be lower. We're not exactly sure, but we'll look at these numbers right now. So anyway, given the lower rates of fertility, the lower rates at which their children are Jewish, and the next point, the higher rate at which those children in turn intermarry, we see that non-Orthodox Jewry is on a path either to numerical decline, and I'm not sure about that, but certainly on a path to, on average, Jewish disengagement. There'll be some engaged Jews. There'll just be fewer engaged Jews who are not Orthodox, however you conventionally measure engagement. I mentioned that their children intermarry. 83% of the Jewish children of intermarriages married non-Jews. And when you put the numbers together, between 17% married Jews, if you look at only those of all children, it feels like 8 or 9% of the children of intermarried couples are marrying Jews. And some of them will raise Jewish grandchildren. What it means is that 5 to 7, 6, 8% of the grandchildren of the intermarried will be raised as Jews, just to give you the depth of the number. At the current moment, it looks like, in part of the sample, that doesn't include Jews. These are non-Jews who were interviewed because they had some Jewish connection. Some of those non-Jews had Jewish parents. It looks like there are about 2 million people in the United States who have a Jewish parent and do not themselves identify as Jews. Generally, they have one Jewish parent. And assuming that it's about equally split between men and women, for those of you who are mostly concerned about halachic Jews, that means there are about 1 million halachic Jews who don't see themselves as Jewish right now. And that number will grow. So, in this audience, I feel extremely comfortable because it's an audience that I actually have cried at various points when I've presented these numbers. I'm giving you a clinical presentation right now. I think it's sad. It's upsetting that there are 2 million people around who have either a Jewish father or a Jewish mother who don't think that they're Jewish. I think it's sad that the number of non-Orthodox Jews, or at least engaged non-Orthodox Jews, is declining, is set to decline. I think it's dangerous for the Jewish people that we have, that we, you know, kind of lose cultural diversity within Jewish life. And for those who actually, you know, since, you know, count mitzvahs, there'll be fewer Jews doing fewer mitzvahs. However you look at it. In this situation, and now Rabbi Weil suggested I might have something to say, because we've had wonderful conversations, which I certainly learned much from him and his colleagues here at the OU. In this situation, and something I've said for a long time, we need the engagement of Orthodox Jewry in the larger community. And I know I'm coming to the chassan, or the kala. And I have some work to do with the other party, but on this side of the ledger, I can say I've been saying this for a long time. I remember I stood up at another rabbinical convention, and I said, we have to invite the Orthodox here, they have to be part of our conversation. It has to be Orthodox people here, and I basically got a response. Ein imila daber, ein almala daber. They won't talk to us, and we won't talk to them. And so I don't have to mention which major denomination I was talking about. It doesn't matter. That type of attitude needs to change. We need to have more social contact between Orthodox Jews and non-Orthodox Jews. In that social contact, they will mutually influence one another. And if it's on Jewish matters, I think the more committed Jews will have more influence on the less committed Jews than the other way around. And we know from everything we know that people who associate with other people adopt the other person's habits. If you want to lose weight, go to the gym, eat better foods, but find people who look thin. It actually helps you lose weight. If you want to stop smoking, hang out with non-smokers. These are all things that you can do. But now, we want the non-smokers, we want the people who've lost weight, the people who are healthy and vital. We need those people to be associating with the rest of Jewry. We need to have a situation in which we understand that the future of the Jewish people is at stake here, and Orthodoxy can provide openness and communication. And yes, I guess that means that we have to do things that are normatively challenging to many of us. There really is no reason why there's a conservative convention opening up soon. United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism. There's a URJ, Union of Reform Judaism. It ought to be part of our normal, everyday ceremonial life that Balabatim, representatives of other movements come and issue greetings to the other denominations, saying we're all in this together. We're going to have our differences. We don't always agree, but that ought to be par for the course. It is not par for the course. People don't see the other denominations, and I say the visibility of Orthodoxy in conservative reform and other precincts needs to be highly increased. We need to have Orthodox speakers. We need to have people coming around. We need to have people who need kosher food, who need a Shabbos minion, who need things happening at other places. You can make that difference and legitimate all kinds of movements in the appropriate direction. There'll be effects on Torah study, on Shabbos, on Israel engagement, all the things that you really care about. You can help make this happen. So that's my challenge to you. If you agree, I have a lot of work to do to go across the street and talk to other people about inviting you in. But I really believe that if we have a sense of crisis and urgency, as we should, that all sides are prepared to overcome the divisions that have been unhealthy for us in the past, but that are really critical to get over now.
Thank you very much, Professor. We have a small studio audience here, which may or may not be visible to our viewers on their computers.
This audience has mixed seating. No one's davening right now, so I think we're fine.
We have five questions that were sent in advance via email, so I'd like to present those to you.
So I know it's not the Seder. It's something else. Okay,
correct.
Go ahead.
This is five, not four, and there's no liquor here. The first question is, and this is possibly the most pugnacious, perhaps, is that a good word? Doesn't the Pew Report prove clearly that the more we water down the Torah, the more assimilated we become? Does the Pew Report not validate what Rav Sadia Gaon taught hundreds of years ago, namely that our people are not a people without the Torah?
Torah and Orthodoxy and so forth and so on are all positive things. The question is, when you have a Jewish population that is already, since post-halachic, post-Torahitic, who's going to teach them? Who's going to lead them? Who's going to reach out to them? I believe that most Orthodox rabbis would fail in most Reformed temples. Be an Orthodox rabbi. Go to a Reformed temple. You go and educate. Let's see what you can do. I don't think you'll do a better job. I think you'll do a worse job. I think they'll reject you. I think they'll leave. So I'm glad you call this person pugnacious. So I'll be pugnacious.
I like him personally.
And pugnacious in return. You know, would the world be a better place if there wasn't conservative reform? That's really what the question is. Rabbi Lloyd Sachs, advanced the policy in the United Kingdom. It hasn't necessarily worked. You can argue, plus or minus, but that's not the world that we have. It's not an actionable plan. Asking conservative reform to close shops so that we can have a free field day, is just not going to happen. So, even if it were a good idea, that's a bad idea, but even if it were a good idea, it's a non-actionable idea. So let's go on to ideas that actually can work, because we don't have the luxury of being triumphalist and impractical. That we are commanded to be practical, to be effective. That's not an effective policy.
I'd just like to point out before we go on, there are three different ways people could ask questions if they'd like to join the conversation. First of all, on the email that so many people receive, they can simply go to the submit question button, and we'll see that pop up on a screen here in the conference room. People could also go to Twitter and put something up on Twitter with the hashtag OUPewReport. And if anybody's in the room and would like to ask a question, we'll bring a microphone over to you, and you can do that here. I'll point out, we do need to bring a microphone to you so that everybody watching on their computers can hear you.
But I want to add one thing, not because I'm running for office here. I will go to the other movements, and I will say they should recognize the success of Orthodoxy in this arena. I have said it, and that part of their responsibility, not necessarily to do tshuva, but to recognize that there are elements in Orthodoxy's approach that have in fact worked, and they should be big enough to say yes, that's a good thing. And I even thought personally, I was raised non-observant Orthodox, and so I have affection for Orthodoxy as well as I do for the other movements as well. Should, as an act of leadership, should different movements take a week? Leadership take a week, and this week I'll be Orthodox. Next week I'll be conservative. Next week I'll be Reform, without violating whatever strictures we have, in order again to model a Klal Yisrael approach to Jewish life. Something of that nature. I thought about doing it personally. So I want to indicate that we have a lot we can learn from each other, and a lot we can teach each other.
That actually plays well into a question that just came in online. Professor Cohen suggested more engagement on the part of Orthodox Jews toward the non-Orthodox community. Do you think the non-Orthodox will feel patronized by the terms outreach, kiruv, that sort of thing?
No, outreach and kiruv. Outreach, kiruv they don't use so much, but outreach they use too. So it's not problematic. Engagement is a neutral term. If you want to say we like to engage each other, discussion, equal playing field, so forth. And we have, we have resources that we can share with each other. There are things that we know how to do better than others. Look, I was so pleasantly surprised, I didn't know this, that the OU puts $10 million, is that right, into NCSY? Is that the right figure, more or less? A lot of money.
Yeah.
Right? I have thoughts about going to a certain major donor who's been giving a couple million dollars to Jewish youth movements and saying, look, we now know what it takes to run our youth movement. It needs a contribution of $10 million a year, every year out. You want NCS, you want USY, Nifty, Young Judea, and these places to succeed. It can't be on the cheap. It can't be $2 million. You care about youth movements. I know you can afford it. Why don't you give $10 million to each youth movement? This is a real conversation I have in my head. Again, I have to have the conversation with the person who could be the in this case, Ba'alat Daka. That's something we can learn from Orthodoxy. It's a model. You have commitment to your children that the others may want to, but they can't afford to. We should learn from this.
So a viewer sent in a question. There's sort of a preamble here that I'll give you, then it gets to the question. He says, while the report makes mention of a dramatic cross-denominational shift toward lower forms of observance, I have not seen mention of any movement toward higher forms of observance. And he says, as you mentioned, tens of millions of dollars are spent each year on NCSY and many other types of Kiruv programs, and certainly claims are made to successes in increased observance among their respective populations. The questioner asks, was this shift in observance observed but considered small enough to be not statistically significant, or was it overlooked or ignored?
The truth is, we don't have, from what I can tell, and again, I don't have the data set, I do have the questionnaire, we don't have good data on observance. What did you do in your youth? What are you doing now? What were your parents doing? What are you doing? All we have are these denominational categories. But let's assume the denominational categories are somewhat indicative. everyone mentions the small percentage of conservative reform and other people who now identify as Orthodox. But a small fraction of the 90% or so that is not Orthodox, even more in the past, who are not Orthodox, when they become Orthodox, actually becomes a major stream. I forget the exact number, but as I recall, 71% of currently Orthodox people said they came from Orthodox homes. It means 29% didn't. That's a lot. So it is not true that if we translate observance into becoming Orthodox. It's not true that Orthodoxy has failed to attract newcomers. It has attracted newcomers in considerable number. I'm going to bet, well, here's something we know and here's something we don't know. What we know is that Orthodoxy has become more rigorous and demanding and has built day schools and other institutions that are completely socializing people. And we see over time that the dropout rate from Orthodoxy has declined, the retention rate has increased, all hand in hand. There are two possibilities where you have a stronger, more bounded Orthodoxy. Not only do people stay more, but either it could become more attractive to people and more people can come in, or there's a bigger wall that people don't want to make that type of big leap. And the truth is, which process is happening more and to what extent? We don't know. We really don't know. When we get the data, we'll be able to look at age by age by age and then be able to determine are there more Bali Tshuva jumping over the tall offense, or are there fewer jumping over the tall offense? We don't know what's happening until we get those data. I would hope within 9 months or so, but it's up to Pew.
Alex, could we go to the phone? I believe Rabbi Weil wanted to ask a question, if he's still with us on the line. Rabbi Weil,
are you
there? Thank
you, Mayor, for the opportunity. Actually, I wanted to ask, Judah Isaac had an interesting question for Dr. Cohen.
Rabbi Isaac, are you there?
One second. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the difference in retention among the Orthodox? That it seems to say older Orthodox had a greater number of Jews who were older who said they're no longer Orthodox compared to younger Jews.
I think I understand your question. Both the New York study and the Pew study show the same phenomenon. Older people who are raised Orthodox heavily left Orthodoxy. Younger people, and now younger adults, for example, today, in the Pew study, also the New York study, over 80% of the younger adults raised Orthodox stayed Orthodox. And you should know it's higher among the Haredim and lower among people who define themselves as modern Orthodox.
Can you give any
percentages? Look to the New York study or look to the Pew study when it comes out. The New York Jewish population study has actually many of the same numbers. I give myself as an example. I was raised in Judea Center, Brooklyn, on Bedford Avenue in Brooklyn. When I was growing up, we had mixed davening. About 10 or 11 years old, there was a mechitza put in, a little mechitza. I don't think that there were any Shomer Shabbos people, certainly not in my Hebrew school. Maybe the rabbi and the cantus children, they were Shomer Shabbos. I didn't know any. So I went to shul, and then I'd go out and play football or something. And my father and I would go to shul, and he'd play pinochle, and I'd play football. That was Orthodoxy in Brooklyn in the 1950s. I dropped out of that Orthodoxy. You know, either I would have to change my observance, or I'd change my formal denomination. I would be actually more observant in British Orthodoxy than British Orthodox Jews are today. You should just know that this is the world that we had. So obviously, people like that dropped out of Orthodoxy. Today, 12 years of yeshiva, Shana Aleph, Shana Bet, maybe I'll make Aliyah, maybe I'll get Smicha or Maharat or whatever the case may be. It's a different world, and the standards are higher, and the education is stronger. Oh, and we also have much more concentrated communities. We have many, many people living together in the same neighborhood, supporting each other's Orthodoxy. That makes for greater retention.
Okay, let's go to a question from Twitter, and then we have a few process questions that we should get through quickly because people want to know and want to understand how the sample
sure.
was taken. So
we'll
get to a few of those. First, a question from Twitter. This is from at E. Fink, and his question, my question for the professor, what are halachically observant Jews to do about the existing rabbinic ban on interfaith activities?
Talk to a halachic expert. If you're asking a halachic question, then to talk to a halachic expert. I can just give you the social implications insofar as you not engage in interfaith activities, but interdenominational activities or frum non-frum activities, you'll help the Jewish people. There's a cause for everything that we do. Shimon Peres is talking about the peace process said years ago. L'chal davar yesh mechir. So to likiruv, gam yesh mechir. Fine, right? Understand the price, but also understand the need and understand the power to influence Jewish lives. You really can help make a big difference. Please remember, I'll hold it up. There are 10 non-Orthodox Jews who are going to get married next year. This is really sad to say. 3 of them are going to marry Jews, at best. It's a terrible situation. What can you do to have 1 more married Jew, 2 more married Jews? All that will make a difference, and that's why we don't need interfaith activities, but we need interdenominational activities.
Somebody is actually. Let me go on to this one. 2 questions. This is a question actually from, I guess, the Cleveland area. In light of the extensive efforts that were made to reach out to Jews of Russian origin, what concrete steps were taken to interact with the insular Hasidic communities? Were Yiddish-speaking interviewers employed to assist in this process? And in the end, how many Hasidim were actually interviewed? And question number 2, how were the denomination labels determined? If they were self-determined, what adjustments were made to accommodate the fact that being Orthodox in the New York, New Jersey metro area is very different than being Orthodox in small isolated communities? And finally, how many Chabad Jews, clearly Orthodox, but who often label themselves as non-denominational, how are they accounted for?
We don't know about the Chabad Jews, working backwards, like reading from right to left. The denominational labels are self-ascribed, and I am sure that we will find different levels of frumkeit among Orthodox Jews in different parts of the country. New York will probably be higher from everything that we know. But we have to open up the data set in order to answer that question. And in terms of the Russians, I do know that the numbers that we had in the study, which is like about 12% of the population being either Russian-born or the children of Russian-born, seem to indicate that there was a significant success in reaching the FSU population. In New York, we had Yiddish-speaking interviewers. Pew did not, but they succeeded at least as well as we did, if not more so, in reaching Russians and also reaching Yiddish-speaking Jews. So I have no complaints about the methodology.
Thank you. I'll combine 2 questions that came in. They both deal with the general issue of geography. First is, what sense do you have of the situation for Jews and Orthodoxy in Jewish communities outside of large population centers? Does Pew provide any insight? I know you've touched on this.
It will. We know nothing right now.
So we don't know the trends the same?
We have Jewish community studies, which I think actually would be more valuable than Pew. Look at your communities. Look at Cleveland. Look at Chicago. Look at Baltimore. Look at New York. You can do comparisons.
Okay, and then another question.
And by the way, Dr. Jacob Euclides has done a comparison of those 4 cities. And it's extremely, extremely interesting. Go to Burma Jewish Policy Archive, bjpa.org. You can download that piece and 17,000 other documents on contemporary Jewish life.
Okay, and the other question that I said related to geography, related specifically to marriage. The report indicates that since 2000, 71% of marriages in the non-Orthodox community have been interfaith marriages. Was that number broken down by geographic areas such that possibly the Northeast might have a lower percentage because of the relative density of the Jewish population? And vis-a-vis the general population versus areas like the West, where the rate might be higher
because
the Jewish density is lower.
Again, the Pew data have not, they have not done that analysis yet. It's not 71% of marriages, which is bad enough. It's 71% of individuals who married, of non-Orthodox Jews who married non-Jews. We know from our community studies, population studies, and decades of studies of American Jewry that there are significant regional differences in intermarriage rates. We know that the East has a much lower intermarriage rate than the West. The West is much higher than the East. And I am, for my non-Orthodox friends certainly, I have cautioned all of them who moved to the West to make sure that their children go to universities in the East. I'm being very serious that this is, that there's more concentration of Jews in the East and there are more traditional norms regarding religion and ethnicity in the Northeast. So all things being equal, for Jewish continuity purposes, if you move to the West, send your children back East. And if, you know, I said half jokingly, someone who made aliyah, someone who moved from San Francisco to New York made an aliyah that's at least as effective in intermarriage terms as going from New York to Yerushalayim. I understand that that may be a controversial statement. I'm an Israeli. I believe in Zionism. I am a Zionist. But nevertheless, from a population point of view, the New York-San Francisco difference in intermarriage is on that order. Really, really quite huge.
Let's go back to the phone for Rabbi Weil. Rabbi Weil, you there?
Thank you, Mayor. A question to Dr. Cohen. In the 29% of the Orthodox community today that you reflected upon, you earlier spoken that 4% of conservative Jews, which makes up 12% of today's Orthodoxy, 3% of Reform Jews, which makes up 8 to 9% of today's Orthodoxy, they have moved, so to speak, become part of the Orthodox community. And we're very proud and optimistic about that very significant percentage coming. Would you speak about the transition or the movement in the other direction from the conservative denomination and the Reform denomination? As well, would you also speak, you had mentioned to us in a pre-meeting that many people who were interviewed who define themselves as Reform were not necessarily affiliated or members of Reform institutions.
Thank you for that point. In Orthodoxy, it's hard to imagine that a person says they're from a denomination that they're not. Because almost all Orthodox Jews belong to a shul. If not, they did or they will. That's not true for conservative Reform. Or when someone says that they're conservative, they may mean they're conservative, they belong to a conservative synagogue or shul, or they may not. And the numbers are 50-50, by the way. For Reform, if they say they're Reform, only one-third belong to a Reform temple. Two-thirds don't at this point in time. So we also know that conservative shul members are more Jewishly engaged than conservative non-shul members. And Reform temple members are much more engaged than Reform non-temple members. So the word Reform means something different to Amcha out there than it does to rabbis and people inside the Jewish Beltway. It's not that they're all, you know, they've all studied Isaac Meyer Wise and that they've decided, you know, that I understand that I really am Reform or, you know, Salma Schechter, I know conservative. These are not ideological commitments. These are descriptions of self. So when we look at the numbers now for Reform conservative and the Jewish engagement numbers do not look all that gratifying, we should understand that this is not the Reform movement per se. These are people who call themselves Reform Jews. I made the same point to the Reform movement. I said, you know, understand that your synagogue members are likely to be much more engaged. Again, the New York study will give you current differences, and Pew study will give us the same sorts of differences going forward. Now, Rabbi Weil also asked about, well, what happens to conservative Reform afterwards? And really the issue is, do they marry a Jew, do they not marry a Jew? This, you know, conservative Jew marries a Jew, they'll have children, they'll have Jewish children, they'll join synagogues. I mean, really in a very, very strong number. Same thing with the Reform Jews marrying Jews. The real issue is how many of these people marry Jews and how many don't marry Jews. If they don't marry Jews, all kinds of things happen. First of all, many of them stop being Jewish. They just say, I'm not Jewish. Halachically, of course, they remain Jewish, but they say they're not Jewish. Not all of them, but many of them do. Many of them say, I'm Jewish, but I have no religion. You know, my wife and I, my husband and I, we've decided we'll raise our kid mixed, or, you know, the middle category is not non-Jewish Jewish. The plurality is a combination, partially Jewish, and so forth and so on. Most of those kids do not grow up to be Jewish, but they're given a choice as to what they want to be, so to speak. So that's really the crossroads. And the question is, how do we create situations in which Jews will marry Jews? So far, we've been plowing one furrow, which is the education furrow, the meaning furrow, and so forth and so on. It's very, very important. But there's another one, and that is the social connection furrow or dimension. And we need to add to our emphasis on text and meaning and Jewish activity, we need to remember that social connections supports all that and grows out of all that. And we need to think about, how do we get Jews together with other Jews? There's all this evidence that people fall, you'll find this hard to believe, but people fall in love with, are attracted to, and marry people they meet. So if I need to repeat that because it's a little complicated, you'll come up to me afterwards. But it really is the case. So why don't we try to think about policies that will take Jewish young adults who are not married and bring them into contact with other Jewish young adults. Birthright, by the way, does that. What else can we do? I mean, there are many things. Camps do that. Youth groups do that. Hillels do that. How can we multiply the chances that young adults who are Jewish will hang out with other young adults who are Jewish? And my last point is that it turns out that before people get married, vast majority say, I'd like to marry a Jewish person. And then when they marry a non-Jewish person, they marry later, indicating, we think, that they waited to find the Jewish person and they couldn't find the Jewish person and they married a non-Jew. More often than not. These are not like Philip Roth types who are saying, or were, you know, erotically attracted to the non-Jew. They prefer Jews. They couldn't find Jews. We need to strengthen our social networks so that Jews find Jews, and Jews refer dating partners to their Jewish friends. That's part of what we need to do in order to serve the Jewish life going forward.
Okay, we have a couple of questions from the audience.
Hi, how are you? Hi. I wasn't here the whole time, but I wanted to know if you addressed the difference between Sephardim and Ashkenazim, and also the idea that Sephardim don't necessarily have the breakdown Orthodox, Reform, Conservative, right, as much as the Ashkenazi community does. So if you can address that.
I, as far as I can recall, the Pew data set will not allow us to do that. The New York data set does. I have some work on the Syrian community in New York, but the answer is no. Basically, I don't know anything.
Thanks.
There's another question right here.
Is family development an issue or an interest of the conservative or reform movements or non-denominational Jewish organizations?
What does family development mean, please?
Getting married and having children.
Let's put it. I believe that this is a Jewish. It is in Jews' interest to have pro-family policies in America. Part of our problem is we're living in an America which has non-marriage, later marriage, low birth rates among upper middle class people. We are upper middle class Americans. One way we can do things is do work among ourselves. I know we're 2% of the population, give or take, but we're an incredibly high percentage of the influencers, the policymakers, the thought leaders, so forth and so on. I think we need to figure out what would family-friendly policies look like, what would a pronatalist policy look like, to change America's norms. Don't forget, we're different from Europe. Absolutely better. Israel's much better than the United States on these matters. What could we, as Jews, do to change America in a way that will make marriage earlier?
Change all of America?
All of America. All, yes. Change America, not just Jews in America, because there's a whole issue about what they call family-friendly policies, daycare, tax write-offs, and school vouchers, all kinds of things that we can do to make getting married and having children more prevalent. Don't forget, there was a time when it was more prevalent. We're not talking about a revolution here, but we're talking about shifting the norms. And it's worth a try. We're in a very difficult situation. We have to do all kinds of really crazy experimental things in order to make the situation better.
Socially speaking, we're effectively WASPs. The Hispanics are having more children in any case. We don't affiliate with them, associate with them in business or in society.
Right.
To get the WASPs to have more children is...
That's what I mean. I know what I'm saying. There's tax policy that could help for child care. We could have a system of daycare. We could also have a system of Jewish daycare. We have birthright to go to Israel. Why not birthright to having children? Why don't we do that? It's only several hundred million dollars. We know people who have that kind of money. Let's ask them for it.
All right, we have,
okay,
you have one more from the audience. Okay, we can go a little bit over. Professor Cohen, okay time-wise?
Especially on behalf of gender diversity.
Do I just walk in here? Oh, yeah,
right.
I guess I do.
Yeah.
Okay, the emphasis thus far has been on Jews marrying Jews. We shouldn't forget that the Jew intermarrying comes from a Jew who married a Jew. So apparently it's not enough just to have a Jew marry a Jew. So how do we make committed Jews?
I hear what you say.
Right.
Let me guarantee that a major fraction of Jews marrying Jews are Jews who were themselves the products of intermarriage. The intermarriage rate is much higher.
It started.
I understand. It's double the rate among the children of the intermarried are twice as likely to marry a non-Jew as the children of the unmarried. You can change the numbers, and what I want to indicate that we have we have two tracks. They both need to work. One is Jewish education, and we already can imagine that. We have to do more of it. And the other, as I'm saying, is Jewish social connections, and getting people to go to the right universities, live in the right areas, get to know each other, help them multiply JD 10 times with different apps. Please do not totally equate. Partially, yes, but not totally equate intermarriage or in marriage with Jewish commitment. Jewish commitment doesn't necessarily lead to in marriage, and lack of commitment doesn't necessarily lead to out marriage. I know it doesn't, and I'm trying to. I statistically once showed that zip code is a better predictor of intermarriage than is Jewish education. The way you mean it. Saying that being Jewish is important.
That sounds very vague.
That's the answer that we have in the questionnaires. Saying going to Israel, going to Tefillah, having Jewish learning as part of your life. All of these measures put together.
Well, what you just described is not someone likely to marry a non-Jew.
You're incorrect, Sicha. People who live in Phoenix or in San Francisco, or even, by the way, in Suffolk County, whatever, people who have reasonably high scores on Jewish education and socialization do have higher intermarriage rates when they live outside of areas of heavy Jewish concentration. And the opposite is true. A Jewish boy or girl growing up on the Upper West Side with minimal Jewish commitment, Sunday school, a bar mitzvah, kind of, whatever, that person, because he or she has lived in the Upper West Side, where there are lots and lots of Jews, that person has a much higher chance of marrying a Jew than certain day school kids in San Francisco.
And what about their children?
I'm saying, don't oversell commitment. It's partially important. It's inherently important 100% in its own right. But as a predictor of in marriage, it's only part of the story. Otherwise, how do you explain the vast differences in intermarriage among non-Orthodox Jews in different parts of the country, in different counties within the same metropolitan area? And we know that. Brooklyn, Queens, Nassau, Suffolk. Low, middle, somewhat higher, very high. It's not only the mix of people in those areas, it's also the extent to which they have contact with other Jews. They're both important. So let's work on both. We've only been working on one, which is to make only a small percentage, only 10 or 20% of the population makes those choices. A lot of Orthodox people, a few others. 80% of the population, who are our people, unsere Leute, they're our people, they don't make decisions that way. Don't think Orthodox. Think non-Orthodox. Think about those people, because those people are our people. They're your people and my people.
One more question in the room, and then we'll start to wrap up.
So I just have a question more about the Pew Report. I noticed that it did group together modern Orthodoxy and ultra-Orthodoxy, but then when it broke down the numbers a little more in detail, it seems that the modern Orthodox numbers are very skewed by the ultra-Orthodox numbers, which are much, much higher. Do you find that this has an effect on the way that the report sees Orthodoxy in general?
Again, when we get the data set, we can disassemble them. I think there was something like 6%, 4%. You know, we're talking about 10%.
Yeah.
About 60% were Haredi, mm-hmm. so-called ultra-Orthodox, mm-hmm. and 3 or 4% were modern Orthodox and other terms, self-described. The self-described actually makes a difference. Not all the time. There's some fluky cases, you know, people who say they're Orthodox and have very non-Orthodox behavior. But we'll only be able to look at those results afterwards. And fortunately, Pew, following the lead of the New York study, where we were the first ones to ask people, Orthodox, oh, good, what type of Orthodox? We did that in the New York. The people at Pew liked that. And because they wanted to have enough modern Orthodox and Haredi Orthodox to analyze, they did an oversample of Orthodox Jews, because they know more or less where they lived. And so we have actually a lot of cases who are Orthodox. So this will be a great study of Orthodoxy in the United States once we get our hands on the data. They knew enough to downweight the people after, since they were oversampled, they got less votes when they came in. But from a statistical point of view, we have a lot of Orthodox to analyze. And so it's more than 10% of the 3,475 interviews that they did. It's a wonderful, wonderful sample for all of us, in particular for the Orthodox.
And a final question, which will play right into what you were just talking about. It's representative of anecdotally of something that I heard from a number of different people. It comes from Twitter, and @GillStudent is asking about what he calls the few strange results. Do they raise questions about all the results? He gives the example, 24% of ultra-Orthodox handle money on Shabbos, 15% of Orthodox attend non-Jewish services a few times a year. These sound very strange, he's asking about that.
You should know, first of all, self-described Orthodox respondents living in areas with a lot of other Orthodox Jews showed fewer of these anomalous cases than self-described Orthodox Jews living in places where there are hardly any Orthodox Jews, right? So there are some people here who probably are not parts of Orthodox communities, and they're answering the questions. Second, on questions that were asked in the 2000 NJPS, National Jewish Population Study, and here, and we had Orthodox and Orthodox, the Pew people actually ran to see what was happening, and the same anomalous results occurred then as now. And third, we have to recognize that there are some non-observant Orthodox still around. I mean, my childhood continues in some people. And I'll tell you a quick story, which will, some years ago, I was meeting somebody. I said, let's do a meeting next week. He said, yeah, I'll be in New York. I said, oh, good. He's not from New York. He says, when should we meet? He says, Shabbos. I said, okay, we can do that. The man is president, was at the time president of his Orthodox synagogue in some place that's not in the New York area. So we meet, and let's call him Saul. He wasn't Saul. I said, Saul, so when'd you get in? This morning. I said, this morning? And we went through this whole, and he said, yes, yeah, flights and Shabbos are cheaper. I want you to know that he's a man, he's now 70 years old, give or take. He exists. And there are lots of such people out there. From Pew, we'll find out how many who are not just, you know, kind of misguided, mislabeled Orthodox, but people who are labeled themselves Orthodox and are part of Orthodox communities. and probably even a few in the New York area as well. So let's understand that there is much more of a span of observance among self-identified Orthodox than we normally believe, and it's a well-known social phenomenon that you take your images from people that you know. These are people that you don't know. Last point, this is the obverse of people saying, what do you mean? I know all these intermarried people who are active in Jewish life. What's the problem with intermarriage? And they do, and they're convinced of it, because all the people they know, they're in Jewish life, and they know lots of, you know, active intermarried people. It's not true for all the intermarried people. They're much less active in Jewish life than you believe. And similarly for Orthodoxy, there are a lot of non-observant Orthodox. When they answer a questionnaire asked by a non-Jewish interviewer, they're more likely to tell them, I don't do that, you know. So that's why we get some of these fluky results. And we get some kinds of, you know, results that make no sense. That's just true of every survey. These surveys would not pass a test of Batel B'Shishim, I assure you. But maybe Batel B'Shloshim, Batel B'Esrim. There's some imperfection in these studies. Lots of things can happen. But overall, the results are totally consistent with everything we've seen in the New York study and in previous studies of American Jewry. I'm very, very impressed with the results and the contribution that essentially non-Jewish research center did to Jewish life.
Professor Cohen is a research professor at the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. He was one of the sociologists who closely consulted with the Pew Research Center on this report. I'd like to thank him very much for coming in today. Thank you, Professor Cohen. Thank you to the people who helped make this happen. Thank you to Miriam Weiland, Eliana Schwab, Malka Pearl, Ellie Leibowitz, Alex Cook, our engineer, Gary Magner, Dan Hazzoni, Rabbi Judah Isaacs, and, of course, our executive vice president, pardon me, Rabbi Stephen Weil. And thank you very much, everybody. Have a great day.
Thank you.